Next session number 6799, rule number 1.
Now this is Group Captain A.J. Bannum of Ashbury House, Ashville, Baldock, Hertfordshire. Group Captain, would you like to sort of give me your start off on your story, please?
Well, I was born on the 30th of June 1913 in Royston, Hertfordshire. I was educated at the Perse School, Cambridge. And after leaving school, I worked for about 4 years with the North Metropolitan Electric Supply Company. But I got fed up with that, as there didn't appear to be very much progress. And I applied for a short service commission in the Royal Air Force. And in due course, I underwent a board of interview and was accepted for training as a pupil pilot.
What year was this? Did this short service commission start?
I actually commenced training as a pupil pilot on the 25th of November 1935. So mm-hmm. I imagine my interview was sometime during the previous summer.
I see.
And I started training as a pupil pilot at a civil flying training school, which was a new concept at that time. This one was at Desford in Leicestershire. And I, with about 30 others, we were the first course there. We started on, as I say, the 25th of November, and the buildings we lived in weren't even complete. The paint was wet. however, we got on with flying immediately and in due course completed 50 hours flying, half of which was solo, by the beginning of February 1936. After that, we spent the next 3 weeks at Uxbridge as a course for 3 weeks of square bashing.
Yes.
And at that time we were gazetted acting pilot officers and were fitted out with our uniforms. At that time we had, of course, the normal tunic and slacks and a hard hat, but we also had number one dress was still breeches and puttees.
Really?
Yes. And then, of course, we had to have mess dress as well. On the 25th of February, I was posted to number 11 Flying Training School at Wittering. On the second course there, the first course was 3 months ahead of us, and we were on the second course, where we converted to service aircraft. There were two terms, Harts, Hawker Harts for the first term, and in which we did 44 hours, or I did 44 hours. Then the second term was advanced training as fighter pilots, by which time we'd all been segregated into our to the particular branches we were liable to go. And in my case, it was to the fighter section, and we flew Hawker Furies for a further 25 hours. And we also did a gunnery course at Sutton Bridge. Northcotes it was, off the Humber. Then in August 1936, I was posted to 19 Squadron, Duxford. I arrived there, and of course there was nobody there because the squadron had been moved up to Sutton Bridge for gunnery and was there for a month, and so I, with one or two other new boys, were left twiddling our thumbs at Duxford, and more or less permanent orderly officers. We were able to get a little bit of flying in on Avro tutors borrowed from the Cambridge University Air Squadron, which was stationed at Duxford at that time. I eventually joined B Flight in 19 Squadron. Flight commander was Flying Officer De Salis, and the squadron commander was Squadron Leader Turton Jones. In our particular flight, Johnny Kent was number two of the flight, Flying Officer. From then onwards, our work was general flight and squadron training, flying in Gloucester Gauntlets. It included night flying, gunnery. We had, I think we were one of the earliest squadrons to have Browning guns. And I remember we had a good deal of trouble with them to begin with, getting them to work properly.
Really, why was that?
Oh, I don't know. Any new implement was had its bugs in it.
Yes.
And I think there were new fittings in the aircraft.
Mm.
And, I remember I spent a week or more down at Mottlesham Heath at the gunnery school there while they tried to sort out bugs.
Yes.
In the Browning gun. However, they eventually worked, and they worked extremely efficiently.
What was Duxford like in the early days when you first came there?
When I first went there, we were living in the old mess. In fact, we junior sprogs, I suppose there were 10 of us, lived in one hut altogether, you know, in a dormitory to begin with. They were building the new mess at the time.
You're talking about the officers' mess, aren't
officers'
you?
Mess. Yes, I know. Yes.
Yes.
As far as the hangarage is concerned, very much as it is today, the old-fashioned
1918
hangars,
yes,
with concertina doors.
Yes.
And, which I think is still there to this day.
Yes.
The whole place, as far as the domestic side was concerned, was a bit of a mess because, you know, there are trenches all over the place where they were digging, laying new foundations for the new mess and so on.
Mm.
And, of course, the married officers' married quarters were not built at that time. They came along later.
Where did the officers live? Did they have their quarters over the other side of the road?
They are. Well, now you come to ask me. I honestly think most officers lived out of the aerodrome altogether.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't actually have officers' married quarters on the aerodrome.
I see.
That came at a later date.
So it was just the NCOs and men which are on the...
Their buildings, of course, were up, most of them, anyway.
Mm.
There have been many more added since, of course, but basically they were there. But, of course, at that time, there were considerable restrictions on getting married.
Really?
I mean, an officer was not allowed to get married unless he was a squadron leader or over the age of 30 without special permission of the commanding officer.
Really?
And that wasn't often and lightly given. That's when I first went there.
Which was when?
In 1936.
Really? Late as that?
So, you see, there were only very, very few officers who lived off the premises.
Yes.
As far as the squadron officers were concerned, we all lived in mess. We messed in, and there was a pretty strict regime of mess discipline. We had to dine in full mess kit 4 nights a week, for instance. And you were not excused, those. You had to be there. Wednesdays you could dine in a suit. And you could go in for dinner any time you more or less liked. And, of course, Saturdays and Sundays you could dine in a suit and feed when you wanted to. But the other 4 nights of the week you went in when you were on parade, and you went in when the gong went, and you didn't get up until the president let you go.
Right.
But I look back on that time with great fond memories, because it was a first-class discipline.
Yes.
And I wouldn't have missed it for the world. We always used to bind like hell about having to change every evening into mess kit, but we all had first-class batmen who made life very easy for us. The new mess came into operation, I would think, probably early 37.
That's the one that's there now.
That's the one that's there now, which of course was a big advance.
Mm.
Going back to 19 Squadron, and my own life in it, in about September 1937 I became Squadron Adjutant. And was Squadron Adjutant when the new CO, Squadron Leader Iliff Cousins, came in January 1938. But then in July of that year I was given command of B Flight on the squadron. And on the 28th of July, the CO plus the CO of A Flight, who was Flying Officer Gordon at the time, and myself flew down to Martlesham Heath to fly the first Spitfire, which was down there in the hands of the testing establishment there.
Mm. This was the Mark 1 Spitfire.
That was a Mark 1 Spitfire.
Like the fixed prop. Yes.
And we were just shown the taps and told to go fly.
Really?
And we each of us flew for about half an hour on the thing and managed to get it down in one day.
What was your reactions or your opinion of the first time you flew a Spitfire?
Oh, it was a tremendous thrill. But, of course, it's so different from a gauntlet. Primarily because, of course, the visibility was so different compared forward for landing and takeoff and that sort of thing.
This was restricted, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, because you've got the whole long
nose
engine right in front of you. And it was very much more restricted forward vision than flying the gauntlet with the old radial engine. It was a great thrill. And then we took delivery, I think, of the first Spitfire shortly after that. Probably, you know, within the next couple of weeks we took delivery of it at Duxford, which was the aircraft which was to be used for development flying, and our instructions were to fly it as up to 1,000 hours as soon as we possibly could.
Really?
And that meant that we used to arrange relays of us from first light till dusk to to fly it round the countryside just to get the hours in.
Yes.
And that we succeeded in doing. I very nearly succeeded in bending it.
How did you do that?
Well, because very early one morning I was on the first trip, and I came back from the southwest of the country, and I thought I would try and do a sort of dead stick approach to the aerodrome. And there was a warning horn in the Spitfire. If you throttle back, this horn would come on to warn you that your undercarriage was not down. But there was also a switch on your throttle, which you could cancel that out if you wanted to. And I made a long approach round the aerodrome from a considerable height, long gliding approach, and this annoyed me considerably. I switched it off, and of course at the critical moment I came over the fence with my undercarriage firmly up. But luckily there was a very live wire in the duty pilot's office, and he fired a couple of red lights at me, and I realized at once what it was and was able to pick up the engine and go around again and come down with my undercarriage.
There was quite a number that down. Didn't.
Well,
was it a great...
In time, of course, quite a lot of people have done it.
Yes.
There was one rather notable occasion on an Empire Air Day there, where there was a forced landing competition with a Tutor and Magister and some other aircraft and a Spitfire, and the idea was to land on a spot. And the AOC was there, and a large crowd of onlookers, and the others all did their trick until the Spitfire came along. And the commentator was saying, oh, he's making a marvellous approach. You see, he's not put his undercarriage down until he knows he's going to be right. And then an awful gap, and he didn't put his undercarriage down. He went in an absolute belly flop in front of everybody, which... took the smile off the face of the AOC. Anyway, another interesting thing was, of course, 1938 was the year of Munich, when, of course, there was a fearful flap.
Mm.
And I had the first three Spitfires of the squadron in my flight. And we had no gun sights on them, but we were ready to go. We'd got guns in them, and we were loaded up, and we were ready to fight if need be, but with no gun sights. They were the only three Spitfires available in the country at that time.
Was that so?
I think so, yes.
Yes.
That far advanced, anyway. The squadron was finally fully equipped with Spitfires, Spit 1s that is, by the end of November 1938. And we got rid of our last gauntlet then. In January 1939, I had the doubtful honour of bending a first Spitfire night flying when I made a very heavy landing. I think I went through the fence at the beginning of the aerodrome, and the undercarriage folded up on there. Then, in March 39, I took command of B flight again, having finished as adjutant, and was made an acting flight lieutenant, and I remained there until September the 3rd, 1939, when I was posted to number 611 City of Liverpool Squadron, who were in camp at Duxford at that time. And I was given command of A flight there. the idea, I think, being behind that, they were all auxiliaries, and group decided that the best thing would be to have at least one regular
and experienced
officer, yes, in the squadron, just to sort of show them,
yes,
the ropes, until they got used to being regular airmen themselves. Yeah. They were a very lively bunch indeed, and we really started the war. I started the war with them at Duxford. I well remember the first day. We spent three aircraft sitting on the end of the, well, they weren't runways then, but in the end of the airfield waiting to take off all day long. It got very boring sitting in an aircraft all day. We took it in turns, 2 hours to stretch, I think, but sitting still in the hot sun was very trying.
This was before they thought up the dispersal points?
Really, yes, it was. We were being dispersed at about that time,
mm,
but that was, you know, literally the first day of the war. The 611 eventually left Duxford on October the 10th and went up to Digby, where I stayed with them until January the 18th, and then I was posted down to Aston Down, which was the first operational training unit. I went down as chief flying instructor. You want to go?
How far?
Yeah.
In your time.
One thing that I ought to have mentioned earlier on, when I first arrived at Duxford, 66 Squadron had just been formed out of what was Sea Flight in 19 Squadron, and that flight complete moved down to its own hangar and formed the basis of 66 Squadron under its flight commander, who was then Squadron Leader Victor Croom. And of course, at my time I arrived there, I came with other new young pilots, some of whom went to 66 Squadron, and they were formed as from 1936.
Were there any other squadrons at Duxford apart from 1966?
No, 19 and 66 were the only ones, apart from the Cambridge University Air Squadron.
Oh, I see. And what were they flying?
They were flying Avro Tutors, but 66 Squadron were gauntlets.
I see. Oh, that's fine.
Well, and of course the Met flight was there.
Oh, yes. What did they fly?
They were flying Bulldogs at that time.
I remember. Yes. Yes, that's interesting. Right, so that's fine. Will you go on from where you we had to come back? Will you go on from where you left Duxford before you came back again?
Oh, yes. Well, from Digby, I was posted to Aston Down, 5 OTU, as chief flying instructor, where we took pupils from the flying training schools and trained them to become fighter pilots. The only problem was that when I arrived there, we only had Gloucester gladiators to train them on. We eventually graduated to Harvard's, and latterly, just before I left, we got a few Spitfires, and we then trained them on Spitfires. From our OTU, after about a month's training, they were pilots were posted direct to operational squadrons.
How many hours?
I would think they probably put in about 25 hours.
And then they were on operational?
And they would go on operational then. Mm. One slightly amusing episode didn't redound very much to my credit, but I used to take pupils up in a flight of three and lead them in formation flying in gladiators, and just to test them and see if they were, you know, how they were coming on. And I well remember on one occasion, I was very careless, but I got into the plane from a previous flying instructor while the engine was still running, and took off for the flight and took them through some training. But I omitted to notice that he had, the previous flyer had left the petrol on reserve. And after about 20 minutes, there was a deafening silence, and I had no engine, you see. I looked down then and saw the petrol tap was on reserve, and I thought, oh my God. So I bent down to turn it on reserve and found it was already on reserve, and thought, oh well, that's that. And so I put it down in the first available field there was, and safely managed to land. And in due course, a policeman arrived on a bicycle and asked me what the trouble was, and I told him. And one of my pupils flew back to the aerodrome and reported that I had forced landed, and they came out to collect me. But they first of all flew out somebody with a guard, and so I said, why, this is rather silly, I can look after this. And the police said, well, no, as a matter of fact, you've landed in a German nudist colony. However, I didn't see any of the inmates, and in due course, of course, they came along with some petrol, filled up the tank and flew the and I flew the plane out back to base again.
The field was big enough for you to get off on.
Oh yes, yes. I got a slight wigging from my chief instructor.
Yeah, I was imagining you did.
In